This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.
John Whitehead is the founder and the director of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org, and he joins me live in studio. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We talked in the last half hour with someone you know very well, Richard Viguerie. He's got a new book out, sort of taking Republicans to task for abandoning the conservative movement. What's your take on what he was saying? Because I know you were here listening.
Well, I know Richard Viguerie. I think that he's absolutely correct. I mean, the conservatives that I know have stood for a smaller government, virtually no wars, and economic responsibility, financial, fiscal responsibility, and the present Republican regime obviously doesn't believe any of those. So, yeah, conservatives I talk to now are very, very concerned that the Republican Party's lost its vision. It's basically been hijacked by people with a different view than the neoconservatives, is that what, you know, exactly what they call them. So, I think that I've known Viguerie for, 20-some years, and it's amazing to see those kind of people who were so pro-Reagan, so pro-right-wing, now sounding almost middle-of-the-road or somewhat civil libertarian in their viewpoints in terms of asking for the president to back off of his executive orders, and they really criticize him on his stance on the Constitution and
immigration
and surveillance, immigration, all those issues. And they almost sound like Democrats, which is, I don't think it forebodes well for the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But I'm not all that, I'll be honest with you, I'm not all that impressed with the Democrats right now in Congress. So I think that we've got a tremendous leadership vacuum at this particular point in history.
Yeah, on both sides.
On both sides.
I totally agree with you. I mean, you watch the news and you look at these two parties, you look at the, it's like there's no alternatives. Where is the leadership? Where is any leaders that'll step forward, listen to the American people, and think about America and not just their party? It's just, you can't find them.
Yeah, and they don't have they have a poor sense of history. They have a poor sense of the Constitution. Most of these people don't even know what's in the Bill of Rights, some of the most important things. And some of them are lawyers, which is astounding. And I ask people quite often when they see the debates, who would you vote for? And people just, it's sort of like, you know, it's like going to the store and there's 15 cold medicines and they're all the same brand. And, you know, you just take a random choice. And so it's, I think one of the great disappointments I know among conservatives and liberals that I talk to, especially out of D.C., is the fact that the Democratic Party has come in and kind of laid down in front of George Bush. And we'll talk about this earlier, though. I think the one strength George Bush has, he's undaunting. He just moves forward. It doesn't really matter what anybody does. He moves forward and does what he wants to do.
And one reason he does that is because he has been gotten advice for so many years from Karl Rove telling him just that. You just keep your head down and keep doing this and don't waver. What was your take on the legacy of Karl Rove, who, I guess, decided to help the president from Texas and not be in the White House? Of course, of course, he'll still be helping him, helping the administration. He just won't be doing it as a staff member in the White House.
I think Karl Rove's legacy is the legacy of this White House, and that's secretive government, a government that's accused of being corrupt. Scooter Libby, the scandals, Jack Abramoff, the immense power of the military-industrial complex within the White House, the corporate power in the White House. And it's someone I was talking to the other day, and this is a kind of a left-leaning fellow. We're talking about George Bush, and he says it's obvious George Bush doesn't serve the American people. He's got to be serving somebody else because he just doesn't seem to care. And so I think that's the legacy of Karl Rove. It's the legacy of the White House. It's irresponsible power. It's power without responsibility, and that's where we are today.
We're talking with John Whitehead, the founder and director of the Rutherford Institute. You can learn more online at rutherford.org. And, of course, the phone lines are always open at 977-1070 if you would like to join this conversation and share your take on any of these issues. Would love to hear from you. We were talking in the last hour with Bob Gibson of the Charlottesville Daily Progress about the political fallout from these abusive driver fees that I know you have commented on, and you were saying during the break that the Rutherford Institute may even be involved in legislation challenging them. What's your take on this really arguably bad policy?
Well, it's bad policy, and I think it's bad constitutional law. Early in July, I wrote a letter to the delegates and to the governor and said, you're going to get sued because this has great constitutional weaknesses, and that broke statewide. And I get, you know, a lot of interviews and those kind of things, but and a lot of press on it. But some lawyers obviously took it to heart, and there's been quite a few lawsuits. And I told them it's going to clog the courts, but people have to realize that there was a delegate or legislator in Michigan. Michigan has the same law. He supposedly emailed or mailed all the delegates before they voted on this and said, don't do this. And he gave them the warning signs. You're going to clog the courts. You're going to get the voters up in arms. And that's exactly what's happened. And of all the things that I've seen since I've been in Virginia, and I've been in Virginia over 27 years, this is one of the few times I've seen people up in arms over something. And I think it's good, though. And the reason I think it's good is it's democracy in action.
Yeah, yeah.
But the key to democracy is this, is that supposedly when the people speak, our leaders are supposed to listen. They better listen, and they should be listening. And it looks like this thing's going to be changed when they reconvene next year. So if not, I mean, the lawsuits are going to continue, and I think some people that are running for office are going to find some stiff opposition.
We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. Bob Gibson was pointing out in the last hour that this policy came out of a General Assembly really arguably led by the House Republicans, very conservative anti-tax House Republicans, who are politically terrified of passing any kind of a tax for fear that they're going to get challenged in a primary from a more conservative anti-tax. So everybody's trying to outdo each other in their anti-taxedness. And so you end up with something like a tax on speeding tickets, which is what this abusive driver fee is.
And it has our policemen out collecting the tax,
yeah,
which is a bad thing to do because it's just bad government to do that. But, again, they labeled it a remedial fee so the money wouldn't go into the literary fund to help the schools. They wanted to have it a fee so it would help the so-called roads, and they came up with this preposterous thing. It would only apply to people in Virginia, and they have these huge fines, and the same, you know, the solution, as I was on NPR with Cree Deeds last week, and I think he's right. A penny tax on the gasoline would have been the fairest thing. It would have been the most honest thing, and it would have taken care of the problem. It would apply to everybody using the roads, and we could fix our roads.
Yeah, and it would apply equally to folks out of state, in state,
anywhere. Yeah, because you realize there are kids over here at the University of Virginia that may be over here 7 or 8 years going to medical school or law school. They use the roads. They tear up the roads, and some of them are just as unsafe drivers as anybody else. So,
yeah.
It needs to be fixed.
Tomorrow night at 7 p.m., WINA's morning show host and producer, Jane Foy, will be the moderator. And this event is free and open to the public and sponsored by the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. If you'd like to know more, call 295-4784. That number again, 295-4784. And you could talk to them about abusive driver fees if you want. I'm sure that question will come up, as will likely, John Whitehead, this whole issue of security cameras in Charlottesville. I wouldn't be surprised if that was brought up as well, and you have weighed in on that issue.
Yeah, I wrote a rather lengthy letter to the city council and to the police chiefs long ago, expressing my concerns over the cameras, and there were a number of concerns, but the fact is that all the studies that are out there, they were proposing 30 cameras at $300,000. Now, after I wrote my letter, they've reconsidered. There was an article in the Daily Progress a couple of days ago. But I went through a number of concerns I would have about it. One of the arguments about the cameras is that you don't really expect that you will have privacy in public. And I've always said, well, I expect a certain level of privacy in public. If I'm arguing with my wife or whatever, I don't expect someone to be reading my lips, and that's what you get with the cameras. And, you know, if you go in the drugstore to get a prescription, I mean, should they be reading your prescription packages? If you go into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting or a fertility clinic or a psychiatrist's office, should the government know you're doing that? So I think there is a certain amount of privacy expectation, but One of the biggest problems with the cameras is, although I think they're inevitable, and I'll get to that in a second, is a 2005 British study. Now, Britain has 4 million cameras alone.
Million.
Okay? One for every 14 people. They say the average Londoner, an average Londoner gets shot and filmed 300 to 400 times daily. Okay, on cameras. They did two detailed studies to see if they actually work, and the British, who have more cameras than anybody, came up with the fact that they don't work, basically.
They don't prevent crime.
They don't prevent...
At best, they help in the investigation of crime, right?
Possibly in the investigation of crime, but that's not
true. But they don't make
you
safer.
No. They film crime. That's one thing we know, occasionally. But premeditated crimes... burglary, no, they don't. What they found was, and this is the key, it displaces the crime to other areas. So the crime's going to occur. It depends on where you want it to occur, out in the suburbs or whatever, because people do bad things. So what they came up with, and this is a quote from the actual report, cameras are not an effective way to stop a person that's prepared to commit a certain amount of crimes, especially spontaneous crimes like terrorism, those kind of, it's absolutely not going to do that. So the question is, how, if we're going to do the cameras, and I said this in my letter, you need to have clear guidelines. And Chief Longo is talking about that, but I said that that should really be open to public debate by the civilian people. It shouldn't be done by the police behind closed doors. People need to be able to weigh in on it. It needs to be done carefully. And now they are deciding to do that. And I think that's a good idea because they're very expensive. They give the illusion of security and safety, but... like I say, the most extensive studies done say they really don't work and they don't prevent crime.
We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. If you've got a comment, what do you think about cameras on the downtown mall here in Charlottesville? 977-1070. Pick up your phone. Share that thought. Don't let the minute go by. We'd love to hear from you. So if we do it, we need to go in with both eyes open and realize that we're not putting these cameras in Charlottesville to make us safer because they don't. We're putting the cameras in to help the police investigate crimes.
Yeah. And I think the thing is to we want our communities to be safe, but this is the key thing. We want them to remain free. So the guidelines are really important. For example, people that are watching the film, if they're the police, they should be logging in and logging out what they film. People that they
so that the actions of the viewer are accountable to the citizens.
We know exactly what they're watching.
We know
why
it was John James or whatever,
What they found several years ago in London, and I'm not saying they do that here, but they're actually shooting women's legs and their posteriors and those kind of things. I mean, anytime, I'll be honest with you, anytime government has a lot of time on their hands and a lot of technology, you're going to get waste. And we see that in the national government. We're going to see it local. So I think clear guidelines, masking procedures, digital masking. If someone's not a criminal, why would you keep them on file? Cover their face up. I mean, if they're not committing a crime. Should we actually keep the footage? If you're just filming people walking down the street, reading a book or talking, I mean, why would you do that? So there are a lot of things that we can do. And I served on a blue ribbon panel in D.C. with the Constitution Project, Washington, D.C., with former White House Chief Counsel John Podesta and a number of other constitutional experts. We came up with an inch-thick manual, guidelines, and what to do here. And I think that needs to be read first, studied, and let's come up with clear policies. So I do think that the public has basically been sold that they do work. They're probably inevitable. But if people don't want them, I think it's a democracy. We have a right to vote against them.
So if people don't want them, it sounds like they have a good argument to make.
They have an argument based on the available studies now that they don't work. Yes.
Yeah. John Whitehead is the founder and director of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org. And we're going to talk about a whole lot more after this break here at the bottom of the hour. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. And Aaron is on line one. Aaron, you're on with John Whitehead. Go right ahead.
Hi, Coy. Thanks. Hi, John. This is Aaron Syme, libertarian Crozet.
Oh, hey, Aaron.
I heard you all talking about the downtown mall cameras before, and I didn't hear the whole conversation, so forgive me if I'm being repetitive. But two things strike me as, I don't know if you'd say ironic or just bothersome. I'm not a fan of cameras on the downtown mall, as you could imagine. And two things about it. One is this is almost the same city council that a few years ago made a point of passing a resolution opposing the Patriot Act at the federal level. And I'm certainly not a supporter of the Patriot Act, but I find it kind of ironic that a city that opposes that at the federal level has shown interest, at least, in having camera surveillance citizens. And the second thought that comes to my mind is a lot of these cameras, I understand, would be placed around City Hall the downtown mall. So it seems to me you would have a lot of cameras watching people write on the free speech monument. And I find that kind of ironic.
That's a great point.
Bothersome. And I'd just be curious about your thoughts on those.
Thanks for the call, Aaron. Two great points, especially the second one, that the cameras, they did say that they really want a lot of the cameras around City Hall, and that's where the free speech monument is. So you'd be able to watch what people are writing on the free speech wall.
Yeah, as I wrote in my letter to the council and the police chief, I thought that it wasn't thought out very well, and they needed to stop, pause, look at guidelines. I think that everyone's frustrated about the spontaneous beatings that are taking place. People are getting hit upside the head and those kind of things. And I think everyone wants to stop that kind of thing, and I would want to stop it too. The question we always have to contemplate, and I think you raise it the opposition to the Patriot Act, is that we just want to make sure it's being done according to legal guidelines and maximize our privacy. If there's one thing that we're losing in this society, it's our privacy. A, B, we're losing more and more of our freedoms. And if they don't work, then there are other alternatives. I've suggested, why not three policemen walking the same areas? And you get a human being, someone you can talk to, a friendly face, but someone with a big gun on their side. And that, I think, will definitely deter crime.
I've actually been doing some reading about this since Chief Longo proposed, hey, you know, why don't we use some of this money that you have set aside to fix up the mall? We could use some for cameras, and that would help our investigations. And, you know, and I started doing some reading about it, and the studies show that you actually deter crime not with cameras, but by having more police on the streets.
Yeah.
It actually does work to have cops walking a beat.
And it does deter the crime. That's the point. And you're not being filmed unnecessarily, and you still can retain your privacy. And I think it's good for the people to see a policeman. I mean, a good, friendly policeman.
The challenge is it's incredibly expensive.
It's expensive, but I think that we want to do what's right and kosher with the Constitution. But and I understand this. Policemen get a lot of bad raps today, and I don't think the Charlottesville police are like that. And so I think just good, healthy police deterrence, policemen doing old-fashioned police work is very important.
John Whitehead is the founder and director of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org. And the phone lines are open at 977-1070. If you'd like to comment or ask a question about any of these issues that we're talking about, you pick up the phone and you use that number. It's 977-1070. John, I wanted to ask you about a new book and let people know about it, and we'll also give away a copy. A new book has just been released called Suing for America's Soul, John Whitehead, the Rutherford Institute, and Conservative Christians in the Courts. A very scholarly work. It's a history of your work at the Rutherford Institute. What's your take on now that you are not just the author of many books, you are the subject of a book?
Well, it's like I've said, it's like shaving in the mirror for 30 years, and you all of a sudden find out someone's been watching you on the other side of the mirror and you didn't know it. I mean, I was interviewed for the book. By a professor named R. Jonathan Moore. He studied everything I've ever written, letters, law review articles, briefs, books, and he studies the evolution of my thinking. And as I caution people who read the book, you might think I'm a lunatic for a while. I was. But by the time you get to the last chapter, he says I'm pretty much a decent fellow. And so, but I think it's important to see that kind of work. It's very scholarly, heavily footnoted, but it really shows you the evolution of a mind that went through a lot of different things, but it's an interesting book. I was surprised.
Give us an idea of some of the trajectory of your thinking then, perhaps on any issue. But the central issue that he writes about, he's in the title itself, Suing for America's Soul, Conservative Christians creating litigation.
What he basically documents is the fact that as a young lawyer back in the late 70s, I came up with the idea to start the Rutherford Institute because I had a lot of religious people coming to me, Jewish and Christian, saying we can't get people to represent us. We don't have any money. So I started a group that would pay for the defense of people like that. We have attorneys in Charlottesville, good people like Fraser Salisbury and others who work with us. And it's we pay the court costs. People can't get into the courts. That was the whole idea. Since then, there are many, many groups that have replicated what we do. He shows that he calls them the clones. That's absolutely true. I don't agree with a lot of the clones, and they're really deep right-wing thinking. But what he shows is that I helped start a movement, and then the evolution of my thinking over a period of time from basically a right-winger to a moderate to a more liberal-leaning guy who's a civil libertarian, which is a good place to be at the end of the day. So it's just I think it's a study of a human mind, basically, I'd say, and the public record. He didn't interview me, so he just studied what I put out there on the public record.
Do you wish he had interviewed you for the book?
Yeah, I think and I wrote him a letter, and I said, I think that the good book, and the Seville Weekly has a good article this week on the book. They interviewed the professor, but I think the point he missed was that we have interns that come with us in the summer, lawyers that work for me. They've gone out and started their own groups. They work with a lot of different groups across the country, and they were greatly influenced by what we were doing. So I think that's one big influence he missed.
We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute, and we'd like to give you, listener, a free copy of Suing for America's Soul, the new book. We'll give that to the first caller at 977-1070. Just give Matt your name and tell him you want a copy of the new book about the history of the Rutherford Institute. And let's talk to Chuck. He has been waiting patiently on line one. Chuck, thanks for the call. You're on with John Whitehead. You go right ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. A comment that occurred to me, how the cameras may or may not work on the downtown mall. I have an acquaintance of mine who's British, and he was telling me that part of the significant problem they have there is, you know, when crimes occur in the evening or after hours, it's so dark that the cameras can't distinguish what's going on anyway. And I was wondering if anyone's actually looked at this problem in regards to the Charlottesville downtown area. Where would these be placed, and is there enough lighting for it to be effective? Okay, and another follow-up on that is if that's a yes, perhaps, I wonder if the whole issue might be better served to consider a randomization of the cameras. I'm not for cameras, but if we're going to do it, to randomize where the cameras are. In other words, to say, for example, there's 50 potential sites on the downtown mall area. Well, you wouldn't want to necessarily populate 50 locations. Maybe at any given time, 10, 12, or whatever. That way, I think, would place a lot of uncertainty in the minds of people in the downtown mall and maybe improve the whole issue with privacy. There's my comment. I'll just listen for any replies or comments. Thanks.
Chuck, thanks so much for the call.
They're good comments. I would say that I don't know what studies they've done concerning the lighting. And
it's a great point. I never even thought about that.
But what the British studies show, that spontaneous acts, they do not prevent. They will not prevent premeditated crimes like burglary and theft. Those are displaced to other places, such as your home. And so
if you put a bunch of cameras downtown, the crime's going to move out away from those cameras.
Crimes are going to move away because someone that's planning a burglary doesn't want to be filmed doing it. So they'll go someplace where there are not cameras. But the things I think you have to think about, and I think we as human beings, we tend to be short-sighted, is that eventually surveillance cameras are going to be hooked up to satellites. So you're not going to be being watched by the local police. You're going to be watched by a lot of other folks somewhere around the world. They're going to be watching just generally. The other thing is, someone posed this to me the other day, eventually will the cameras be accompanied with some kind of weapon, just a laser or something, or taser, to be used as a weapon? I mean, you have to think forward. I mean, there's a point where people say the cameras aren't working like we want them to. Now we need to be able to punish people for committing the crimes. And that would be the ultimate. If they film the crime, you shoot people or taser them, and that's it.
So just from remote control, like a video game.
But the point is, no trial, no due process. So eventually the cameras may completely do away with the Bill of Rights. That's a possibility.
John Whitehead,
the protections.
John Whitehead is the founder and the director of the Rutherford Institute. You can read more online at rutherford.org. Along these same lines, you wrote an article recently, some commentary, which we want to remind folks that you can read any of these commentaries at Rutherford.org, and they appear in newspapers around the country. You wrote a commentary called The Instruments of Tyranny.
Yeah, I just started reading articles about how two things that interest me. I didn't know until I researched it. There's congressional legislation which has allowed the Pentagon to give away military items to local police all across the country, and that's happened. There's an excellent study on this. It's called Overkill, The Rise of the Paramilitary Raids in America. It's by a fellow named Radley Balko, and you can go to the Cato Institute website to get it. But what he documented was is that small counties are getting M16s, bayonets, boats, assault vehicles, periscopes, SWAT team gears, flak jackets, all given to them free by the Pentagon. There are small communities, counties with 50,000 people that have helicopters now for whatever reason. So what we've done is we're militarizing the police. SWAT team raids have dramatically jumped from, for example, in 1980 from 3,000 to almost 40,000 a year. Police tend to be more SWAT team-oriented now because they're military. They view things militarily. The other thing is there's 40,000 documented no-knock raids per year. Many people get killed. They go through the wrong door. Police just go through the door. The other thing is I discovered there's 106,000 armed officers across the United States with their different federal agencies from the National Park Service to NASA carrying weapons and participating in raids on homes of police. So what we've developed, unfortunately, is what our founders called a standing army. And they were really opposed to standing armies because they saw them as being tyrannous. That's why you have a Third Amendment saying you can't quarter soldiers in homes. That's against standing armies.
And that's why we had a Second Amendment, so that the folks would have a weapon at home in case we needed to
protect yourself against the standing army.
Right,
that's
right.
What it was for. And so that's what's happened. I mean, I did a commentary. It's much more in detail. You go to Rutherford.org and read it. But it's a little frightening to know that people in the Park Service, NASA, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers are all carrying weapons, Environmental Protection Agency, the IRS. I mean, they all have big guns now. And the thing that most alarmed me was how many of these type of people have a very military mind. In other words, they sort of view the citizens as the enemy, like you would in war, naturally, because they've been trained that way now. It's a very dangerous development.
John Whitehead, the founder and director of the Rutherford Institute. And before we get out of here, we also want to give you the opportunity. If you would like a pocket constitution from the Rutherford Institute, we'll give one away to the first caller at 977-1070. It includes an introductory essay about the Constitution by John Whitehead. And let's see, 977-1070. It's a pocket constitution. We'll give that to you, to the first caller. And there goes somebody right there. What you were just talking about, I find quite chilling.
Yes. And the problem is that they're trained, obviously, but the problem with some of the training, as I read, and again, it's documented on a number of places, many of the so-called federal agents, 106,000 carrying weapons, you're not talking about pistols, you're talking about handguns and
military weapon, yeah.
Yeah, but what we see happening is you're seeing a convergence of federal agencies, local police officers, all heavily armed, very military-minded, with a increasing military presence in our land and a call for it. I mean, how many people know that the president now, through an executive order, can declare martial law at any point he wants to? First president ever can override two federal statutes to do that. So when he decides to, he doesn't have to tell Congress till many days later after he does it. He just go ahead and do it. He doesn't have to ask Congress to do it. So we have to really be careful that we haven't developed into an irresponsible government. And that's why we have our Constitution.
Let's go to the phones, 977-1070. Bill is on line one. Bill, you're on with John Whitehead. I got time for one quick question. Go right ahead.
Why didn't you tell the gentleman who called about the foot patrols that we did have bicycle patrols at one time, and then we ran out of money, I guess, because now we need 17 new officers. I said, if you can find the money for 17 new officers, I think Mr. Chief Longo would just be jumping up and down with joy. And then you would have your foot patrol.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But you didn't correct that gentleman who called, why don't we have foot patrols down there?
Yeah, I didn't hear that about the foot patrols. But I think that's a good idea. I think that the cameras are expensive. They're $30,000 a piece at least. So you're talking 30 cameras, $300,000. So how many police officers can you hire for $300,000.
Yeah, and you've got the, you know, health care and insurance and retirement pension, and it's very expensive to put another person on the force.
But the point is, that will probably deter crime, and it will keep us safe, and you'll have a trained policeman there who knows what to do.
John Whitehead, the founder and director of the Rutherford Institute. And as we go out, let's open up the phone lines again at 977-1070 and give away another copy of Suing for America's Soul, a book on the history of the Rutherford Institute. We'll give that to the first caller at 977-1070. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
We'll talk to y'all tomorrow. Take care.
There is smoke to kill mosquitoes.
Gentlemen.
You've been listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To participate in the program, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, SevoPodcast.com.